The following is a recording from an LTCCC webinar, Nursing Home Advocacy Priorities for 2021 and Beyond. In the program, LTCCC Executive Director Richard Mollett highlights key long-term care policy issues for 2021, including staffing, oversight, and financial transparency. Next, you'll hear from me, Eric Goldwine, about the free resources and programs on Nursing Home 411 and how to use those resources, and we'll conclude the program with a Q&A. Video and slides from the program are available on our website at nursinghome411.org/webinar-2021-policy. Again, that's nursinghome411.org/webinar-2021-policy. Hope you enjoy.
Thank you so much for joining us today. A few housekeeping things before we get started. One, this webinar is being recorded. And secondly, in regard to Q&A, there are two options, I believe this should be at the bottom or at the top of your screen. There's Q&A and then there is also chat. You're welcome to use chat to have discussions or comments among yourselves, anything that might be of interest here, but please use the Q&A for any questions you have for us, which we will get to hopefully at the end of the program. We are going to leave time for Q&A, and we of course appreciate hearing from you. Welcome again. Today we're going to be talking about nursing home priorities for 2021 and beyond. A little bit about LTCCC. As I think most of you know, we are a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, and we're entirely dedicated to improving care and quality of life for the elderly and adult disabled individuals in long-term care. We're talking about nursing homes, assisted living, other adult care facilities. We strongly support people getting care in the least restrictive setting possible, including access to good care and services at home. However, our mission is really focused on making sure that people who do need or choose to go into a long-term care facility receive appropriate treatment and care with dignity. And I should just mention that today's program is entirely focused on nursing homes. As many of you who have attended our programs, or I'm sure know on your own, nursing homes and assisted living, adult care facilities are very different entities, even though they provide care for similar people, including significant populations with dementia or other needs with activities of daily living. The rules for assisted living and adult care facilities are quite different. So we're going to be focused today on nursing homes. The coalition itself focuses on policy research and analysis. We do systems advocacy, and increasingly over the past, I would say 10 to 15 years, especially, we have done a lot of public education, such as the program that we are here today. And as I mentioned before, we are the proud home of two local long-term care OMSN programs in New York State. Our website is nursinghome411.org. I strongly encourage you to visit it, to sign up for our alerts and for future programs. We do some really, are doing some really interesting programs, both in terms of programs like this, as well as our podcast series, which Eric Goldwine is hosting. And of course, we put together a lot of material for the public, which we'll talk about a little bit today. So that gets me to today's agenda. I'm going to provide a brief background on some of the foundations of nursing home care and quality. And then I'm going to spend the bulk of my portion of the presentation discussing policy and advocacy priorities from our consumer perspective, and with the goal of ensuring better care, safety, and resident dignity, both now as we are hopefully emerging from the COVID pandemic and into the future. The program will end with Eric Goldwine, again, our Director of Communications and Policy. He'll be talking about some of the latest resources that we have on our website to support resident-centered advocacy both on an individual basis as well as on the policy level, meaning in your communities, in your state, and national advocacy as well, all of which are important. So here we go, the background on the federal nursing home reform law. So, the United States has the nursing home reform law. It passed in 1987, and it is the basis for all nursing home care in this country. And as I mentioned before, we distinguish between nursing homes and assisted living or other types of adult care facilities because nursing homes are the only type of facility that are recognized under the federal law. In terms of at least quality, and I'm focusing on quality here. So there are only federal rules in relation to nursing homes. There are no federal rules in respect to quality or staffing for other types of residential care settings. And this all is predicated, all is based upon the reform law, which again passed in 1987. So we're talking about quite some time ago now. Every nursing home that participates in Medicaid or Medicare, meaning they take any amount of money from either Medicaid or the Medicare programs, agrees to meet or exceed all of the standards that are laid out in the reform law and the regulatory requirements. Those of you who have visited our website, who have attended our previous programs, know this is really the heart and soul of the work that we do, is focused on helping people to understand what those standards are and to implement them in their lives. It's important also to note from, you know, when we talk about the nursing homes and the nursing home industry, that participation in Medicaid or Medicare, taking that money or accepting Medicaid and or Medicare residents, is entirely voluntary. Nursing homes that don't want to meet the standards in the federal rules can operate private facilities. These things are really important because I want to lay the groundwork and make sure and reaffirm for those of you who are perhaps familiar with it, reaffirm that what we're talking about here is a system in which all of the providers of nursing homes, they have agreed contractually to meet any standard that we talk about here, any standard that we talk about in prior programs. The laws and the rules apply to everyone, but it's voluntary. So no one is forced to do it. This is all a nursing home operator, a business, whether it be for-profit or not-for-profit, saying, I want to participate in Medicare, Medicaid, and therefore I agree to meet or exceed the standards that are provided for. So a little bit about those standards. The nursing home reform law requires that every single nursing home resident is provided the care and the quality of life services sufficient to attain and maintain his or her highest practicable physical, emotional, and psychosocial well-being. All of those things are important. And again, as I'm talking about this, I'm thinking about what we've seen over the last year with COVID and how that literally decimated the nursing home resident population and how many people suffered and how much of that suffering was avoidable and the result of these standards not being met. Now, the federal government relaxed some requirements for nursing homes during COVID-19. However, they did not relax and did not have the authority to relax any of these standards that people have had and continue to have to this very day and will have in the future, the right to have the services, the care, the sufficient staffing needed to ensure that they are able to attain and maintain their highest practicable physical, emotional, and psychosocial well-being based upon their individual needs, abilities, and goals. The law emphasizes, as I hope I'm getting across, individualized resident-centered care. And so that's really important. This is not supposed to be a factory. It's not supposed to be a warehouse. The nursing homes are paid, and as I mentioned before, agreed to provide contractually or obligated to provide care that is focused on what the resident wants, what he or she needs, and to enable him or her to attain and again maintain his or her highest practicable well-being and every single component of life, and all those things, as we know, are so important. Lastly, I just want to mention that having, quote unquote, this is from the federal guidance, having an effective infection control program and policies and implementing them has been part of the standards, since 1991. So when I hear and when I see of residents who are being exposed, most recently to COVID, because facility staff were not washing their hands or were not undertaking pretty basic steps to ensure sanitation, that is heartbreaking, because these rules have been in place for some time, and it is incumbent upon facilities to be providing professional staffing, nursing oversight, et cetera. Secondly, on this last bullet point, I also want to mention is that sufficient staffing has been required since the very beginning, since the 1987 reform law, and when the rules for that reform law went into effect in 1991. None of this is new. It is never appropriate for a nursing home to say that we don't have enough staff to do X, Y, or Z. A central foundation from our perspective of this nursing home reform law that's been in place for, the rules for 30 years now, the central tenet to me is that you have a responsibility, nursing homes have a responsibility to ensure that these are provided to residents. And if they are unable to provide them for whatever reason, whether it be an emergency situation such as COVID, whether it be because they have difficulty hiring staff, it doesn't matter. If you don't have enough staff to meet your residents' needs, then you have two obligations. One is not take in more residents until your staffing and supplies, whatever is necessary, go up. And two is that if you don't have enough staff to meet the needs, all these needs of your residents safely and appropriately, then you need to find a safe and appropriate discharge for those residents. You just don't keep residents. You're not supposed to at least keep residents for whom you do not have the staffing and the resources to provide care in accordance with these important standards. So my question, this is kind of our question for decades now, is if the law and if the standards are so strong, why aren't nursing homes, why aren't so many nursing homes decent and safe places both to live and to work? And by the way, it's not the subject of today's program, but nursing homes are dangerous places to work. And being a nurse aide is actually one of the most dangerous job classifications according to the federal government. Why? Because there is, I would say, it's because of widespread insufficient staffing, and that results in workers taking risks and putting themselves in harm's way when they shouldn't. But in any case, our essential question here is why? Why? What's the problem? If these rules are so good and so resident-centered, what is the problem? And the problem is that, in essence, the laws and the standards only make a difference if they are enforced. Having them on paper and not having our state and our federal government effectively enforce them renders them too often pretty meaningless and unfortunately useless in the lives of residents. And I think we saw that, unfortunately, when it came to COVID. So this is my opinion. This is, what numerous studies that we have done over the years, the Office of Inspector General for the federal government's Health and Human Services has identified, the Government Accountability Office has identified, researchers, reporters, here we have from the New York Times to Forbes, have all identified over and over again that nursing homes too often ignore or flout these basic standards because they are not held accountable for meeting them. So, and moving forward, what I thought would be useful and hopefully interesting today was to talk about some of the nursing home industry's myths that perpetuate a system which we have too often low staffing and poor care and poor quality of life for residents. I just thought this was an interesting quote. It actually came across it a couple of days ago, and I added it here. This is from a piece in the New York Times. Long-term care continues to be understaffed, poorly regulated, and vulnerable to predation by for-profit conglomerates and private equity firms. And this really relates to something that I think is one of the other bases for what we're talking about, or why we need to be talking about advocacy and talk about dispelling some of these myths, is that the nursing home industry has become increasingly sophisticated, I would say, particularly over the last 15 to 20 years, and maybe even more so over the last 5 to 10 years, where we see corporations, just generally speaking, have become much more sophisticated. I know I see on the news, for instance, talks about how I think Apple and Nike and other big companies pay almost no or no taxes every year because they are essentially able to manipulate the system. And that has become similarly true in regard to nursing homes and nursing home care, is that in the absence of effective enforcement of those standards, this is a place where you're guaranteed to get a lot of money. Medicaid and Medicare pay billions of dollars every year. They provide most of the payment for nursing home care in this country. So it's a pretty much guaranteed funding stream. And in the absence of oversight, it allows for people to come in and to, as this person said, predation by for-profit conglomerates and private equity firms. And that's something of increasing concern across the country. So myth number one, there are two myths I want to talk about. One, this is something I've seen since well before my time. I've been with the organization now for 19 years, but I've seen pieces from the 80s and even earlier, the nursing homes complaining, oh, we'd like to provide better care, but we don't get paid enough. And unfortunately, that is just not true. And there are a number of reasons it's not just my opinion, a number of things that substantiate that. Number one is that most nursing homes are run as for-profit entities, and as I've been kind of alluding to, are seen as attractive investment by real estate investment trusts, by limited liability companies, LLCs, by private equity, et cetera. This is something that is people see dollar signs. And just the fact that we have seen an increase in for-profit nursing homes over the past, I would say 10 to 20 years, I mean, it just continues to go up. It belies the idea that nursing homes aren't paid enough money to provide good care. Nursing homes receive, as I mentioned earlier, billions and billions of dollars a year. It's a highly reliable funding stream for people who are interested in making money. It wouldn't make any sense for the for-profit sector of the industry to grow if nursing homes were not profitable. I also wanted to mention here that there are virtually no limitations on the use of public funds to pay for administrative staff, or to siphon off into profits. So nursing homes get $200 a day for a resident, and the rates tend to vary from about $200 to $800 or more per day for each resident that a facility takes in, depending upon the needs of the resident and who is paying for their care. And of course, if a facility is getting $600 or $800 a day, that's bringing in a lot more money, needless to say, than a facility or a resident who's bringing in $200 a day. However, very importantly, as I mentioned before, the nursing homes guarantee or promise to provide good care to any resident, regardless of their payment source. So there's cannot be discrimination in regard to care or to services based upon payment source, at least on the rules. And the problem is, again, those of you who have seen this, family members that I talk to is that those rules are not very well enforced. So we do see discrimination against people who, for whom nursing homes are getting less money. But the issue is that they get all this money coming in, and say they're getting $200 a day to care for a resident. Well, there's no set amount that nursing homes have to employ towards resident care. Some of this is changing a little bit. We've seen this, at least here in in New Jersey, passed a rule last year saying that nursing homes have to direct at least 90% of the funds that they receive towards resident care, and therefore not to administration or not towards profits. New York recently the legislature has passed a bill requiring that 70% of the monies that nursing homes receive go towards resident care. I think that things are still being worked out in both states. I'm not aware offhand of other states that have yet implemented that, but I hope that it will be the trend going forward. It certainly is one of the policy priorities that I wanted to alert you today, is that up to now, nursing homes could take that $200 and they could do whatever we want. So I hear all the time about residents who are given a cheese sandwich, residents that are just fed carbohydrates, that are just fed, we're just talking about this today, frozen food every day or canned food because it's cheaper, rather than providing a fresh fruit or fresh vegetables or appetizing meals or meals served in a dignified way, because they are not required to direct, generally speaking, any of the funding to ensure that meals are nutritious and are attractive and appetizing. The federal rules require that, but again, in the absence of implementation, facilities could say, okay, I only want to put in $2 a day for each resident for their food, and I can then increase my profits. So this is an issue, is that there's just virtually no accountability for where the money goes. And then lastly, this was a tremendous New York Times, Kaiser Health News investigation of about 2.5 years ago, now 3 years ago, excuse me. And they found that 85% of nursing homes use what are called related party transactions to hide profits. When we don't know the extent to which profits may be hidden. And what that means is that related party transaction means that the facility is contracting with someone else. It could be that the property and the nursing home building is owned by somebody else. It could be that the management services or therapy services or hospice services are provided by another company. But in fact, that company is owned by the same individual or entity that owns the operator, that operates the facility, excuse me. And so that is really important, because that's a way in which money just disappears. And it may even look like it's being used appropriately, but we have no idea. There are no limitations in terms of making sure that if you are paying rent essentially to a company that you yourself own, to make sure that that is within the community, what's appropriate for a rental within that community. You could be charging yourself double or triple, whatever you want, and there is no accountability for that. So that is, again, a real concern, is that we have, one, just to reiterate, more and more for-profits running nursing homes. So that, to me, immediately, well, how could it be such a bad investment? How could it be such a razor-thin margin if you're seeing these powerful companies going into the nursing home industry? And then secondly, the fact that we have no accountability, virtually no accountability or transparency with where the money goes. So if you had a child and you were giving them, say, I don't know what allowances run these days, but say you were giving them $20 a week allowance, and they on Sunday, and then on Wednesday, they said they ran out of money. Could you give them money to go to the movies? And on Thursday, they said, could you give them money to go out for lunch with their friends? Wouldn't you begin to question, well, where did the money go that we paid you, that not paid you, but that we gave you to, for your allowance for the week? No one really has ever asked that of nursing homes. People such as us are starting to ask that now, and that's kind of where I want us to move going forward. We have material here. This is our policy brief on nursing home Medicaid funding, and you could see that the trends going up of revenue per patient day. And this is, if you can see right on the left-hand side, that's the Medicaid. So what we hear over and over again is that, oh, Medicaid does not pay us enough money, us being the nursing homes. We don't get enough money. We're losing money on Medicaid. Again, there is no factual basis for that. People can make up, and nursing homes can and do make up their numbers as they go along for a lot of this. And I'm stating it, you know, I don't want to get too much into the weeds in terms of the financing here. So I am stating it as a, with rather broad strokes. But again, what I mean by that is all the lack of accountability that I spoke about before, the fact that there is nothing stopping nursing homes from hiding money before they turn around to our state and federal representatives in the state legislators in Congress, our governors and our presidential administration say, oh, we're losing money. This is, again, what we've been hearing for decades. And there's just, it's like the Wizard of Oz. There is nothing behind the curtain other than men generally telling us what they want us to believe. A little bit about Medicare funding. So I was talking about Medicaid, which pays for most long-term care. Medicare pays for most short-term or rehab care. Now, this has been widely recognized, even with all the gaming of the system that I was talking about, even with the lack of accountability for where money goes and the self-dealing, et cetera, even with all that, the Medicare Payment Advisory Committee, which advises Congress, it's a nonpartisan commission, they have found that the that nursing homes have had profit margins on Medicare for in the double digits for the past 19 years. And again, those profit margins don't take into account the self-dealing and the other ways in which assets are hot are hidden. And then lastly, this is to me, it was one of the most striking studies that I've read in my career. It was the Office of Inspector General, Federal OIG, for the Department of Health and Human Services. This study came out in 2014. It was called Adverse Events in Skilled Nursing Facilities, National Incidence Among Medicare Beneficiaries. So as I mentioned before, Medicaid pays a lower rate, pays generally a $200, $250 per resident per day, a fair amount of money, but not as much as the $500, $600, $700, $800 a day that we see quite often with Medicare beneficiaries. So there's dollar signs there. I mean, that's what we see a lot of the industry really going for. And what the OIG found here is they just looked at the residents for whom nursing homes are making, again, double-digit profits, hundreds upon hundreds of dollars a day to provide care. And the OIG found that one out of three of those residents were harmed within an average of 15.5 days. One out of three within just about 2 weeks of entering the facility. And that almost 60% of that harm was preventable and attributable to poor care. About 6% of those people died, by the way, and over 50% of them were hospitalized. And this to me, you know, as I said, this was the most striking report that I've ever seen, because even when the profits are through the roof, even when the reimbursement is extremely high, nursing homes still do not provide the care that is needed for a significant number of people. One out of three of them were harmed. And this is not some advocates that, you know, people want to dismiss. These are accountants. This is the Office of Inspector General. This is conservative. They are very careful. One out of three of those people are harmed. I remember when I received this pre-publication 7 years ago now, and I felt sick. Even with those people that for whom they're making a ton of money, the care is not provided, the staffing and the appropriate competencies are just not there, even for these big dollar residents. The second myth that I wanted to talk about is that nursing homes are overregulated. And this is something else that I remember hearing since the beginning of my career. I remember attending a legislative meeting here in New York, and an aide to a very senior state senator said, "Oh, my facilities, my constituents," he called them my constituents. The people weren't his constituents. The companies owning nursing homes were his constituents in his mind. And he said, "Oh, they get dinged if the peas are too close to the carrots." Well, as I was saying before, a lot of people aren't even getting peas and carrots. They're getting a cheese sandwich, or they're getting cereal, or they're getting something that is not appropriate. And secondly, that is just not happening. And we have plenty of data to show that. So this is a report that we did in 2015, Safeguarding Residents and Program Integrity. It's on our website, all the data are there. We're actually doing a new report to update this and do something that really builds on what we found here. But it was really striking to see that based upon the federal data, nursing home surveyors, the state surveyors that are supposed to be ensuring that residents are safe and receive appropriate care and treatment with dignity 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days out of the year, that when they, and the instances, even when they identify and substantiate a health deficiency, they only identify that as causing harm or putting any resident in immediate jeopardy 4.5% of the time. It's really low. We're talking about healthcare deficiencies. I'm not talking about something, you know, that there was something on the street or the patio. Well, the patio. Let me rephrase that. Or the parking lot wasn't shoveled. I'm talking about healthcare deficiencies. 96% of the time, 95.5% of the time, they found that there was no resident harm or immediate jeopardy. And this is something that we, since this report came out in 2015, we, in partnership with the Center for Medicare Advocacy, now issue a monthly journal, which I strongly recommend. It's called the Elder Justice Newsletter. And we focus on five or six of these deficiencies from across the country, just so people can see what we mean what is a no harm deficiency, and let people judge for themselves if they think the resident in that situation suffered harm. And we're talking about people who expressed that they were in pain, they were crying, their call bells were unanswered, people who slipped and fell because they weren't properly cared for or they were neglected. I remember one case was a resident who developed a maggot infestation in his scrotum because the facility failed to provide adequate laundry services, cleanliness, and upkeep, housekeeping. He developed a maggot infestation in his scrotum as a result of that. It was substantiated by the surveyor, and that was identified as not causing any harm to a single resident. And why is this important? Because in the absence of identification of harm or immediate jeopardy by a state surveyor, there's almost never any penalty. So in turn, the message to the nursing home industry is that you can provide this level of substandard care and you will continue to get paid and you will not face any penalty. What kind of message does the lack of enforcement send to the nursing home industry? So I'm going to go quickly through a couple of these others, and these are on our, pardon me, someone's calling me, and I'm going to delete that. So just a couple of other studies that I wanted to highlight, and you can see the links here. This program is, I believe, posted on our website. If not, it will be by the end of the day, the PDF for this program. So you could, again, find any of these studies on our website, as well as this program, as I hope you all know, is recorded and posted on our YouTube channel. So GAO found several years ago now, better oversight needed to protect residents from abuse. GAO identified oversight gaps that information on abuse and perpetrator types was not readily available. Facility reported incidents lacked key information. Facilities are required to report when there is abuse or neglect. And if there has been suspicion of a crime against a resident, there are serious reporting requirements, but too often facilities don't follow through on them. And that gaps existed in the CMS process at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the federal oversight agency, for the state survey agencies to make referrals to law enforcement. Why is this important? It means that when bad things happen to residents, sexual abuse, physical abuse, mental abuse, verbal abuse, that it is under-recognized, under-appreciated, and under-addressed. The OIG has done several reports, including the one I mentioned earlier. They found incidents of potential abuse and neglect at skilled nursing facilities were not always reported and investigated. You see a pattern here. The OIG, another report, trends and deficiencies in nursing homes show that improvements are needed to ensure the health and safety of residents. They found that about 31% of nursing homes had a repeat deficiency, meaning that the deficiency type was cited at least five times in separate surveys. Just noting the last, wanted to mention a couple of things here. Most of these were for ensuring that nursing homes are free of accident hazards, providing adequate supervision of residents, providing adequate assistance devices for residents, and providing care and services for the highest well-being. Those things are important. They're meaningful to residents. They're meaningful to families. They're meaningful to us as people, as individuals, but they are not meaningful if they are not, or they're not enabled to be meaningful if they are not implemented, if they are not enforced. CMS guidance to state survey agencies on verifying corrections of deficiencies needs to be improved to help ensure the health and safety of nursing home residents. This is really important. I'll just take a moment, because when a facility is cited, generally speaking, a facility has to develop a plan of correction. If you go to your state's nursing home website, or if you visit a nursing home in person, that plan of correction has to accompany the state survey, the survey document. So you can see what the facility said it is going to do to address the issues identified. But here the OIG has found, and they've done, this is, I believe, a national, they looked at nine states, excuse me, and they've looked at some, they've done some individual reports on states as well. And they have found over and over again that states did not make sure in an effective way, quite often, that the facility actually carried out the plan of correction. Again, something on paper is not meaningful unless it is implemented, and for-profit entities too often will not implement something unless it costs them more to not do it. So it is cheaper, if you're not gonna face a fine or another penalty, it is easier just to ignore it. If you know you're gonna face a fine for failing to implement the correction, then you're more likely to implement the correction because you don't want to have a fine. I hope I stated that clearly. Here, last May, the Government Accountability Office found that infection control deficiencies were widespread and persistent in nursing homes prior to the COVID-19 pandemic. The nursing home industry, and I have to say, I've been working 7 days a week pretty much since last March. I have yet to hear a single nursing home operator or a representative of the industry apologize for the decimation of the nursing home resident population. I have yet to hear a single person say, we could have done better. I can do better. I'm sure, hopefully not too many of you are thinking that right now, but where is the self-assessment? Where is the responsibility for the vulnerable people? Where is the thought about how can I do a better job? It's just too often not there. And as I said, I have not heard it one single time. But here the GAO found that in the years leading up to COVID-19 pandemic, that nursing homes had 82% of them had infection control deficiencies. What's the problem? Again, they're not treated seriously by the states. There's virtually never a penalty associated with an infection control deficiency. It's treated like a paperwork deficiency. And what happens? That results in residents being at risk when there's something infectious like COVID around. So in sum, one is that as taxpayers, we pay for the vast majority of nursing home care through Medicare and Medicaid. Again, that is a lot of money. It's a pretty steady funding stream. We don't, as taxpayers, don't get value for the money that we spend on nursing home care. Two, that the overcredulity of the nursing home industry's arguments haven't served either residents or taxpayers very well. Is that too many of our legislators, too many people actually are led to believe, oh, they can't find more staffing. Oh, it's hard for them, the nursing homes, to hire more. Well, because they pay very little and the working conditions are terrible. Nursing homes say they can't hire staff. They say they're trying. But the fact of the matter is that industry-wide, and again, there are good nursing homes out there. But in my opinion, there are fewer and fewer, and it's a very small minority. But the problem is that nursing homes have, generally speaking, over 100% rate of staff turnover. Is that in the course of a year, facilities, and sometimes it's much larger, sometimes even 200%. Imagine if 100, all of your staff left in the course of a year and needed to be rehired and retrained, et cetera. It's not that the nursing staff are not there, are not out there in the world, is that they don't want to work in a nursing home because the conditions are so inhumane for both residents and for staff. And lastly, and most importantly from our perspective as a resident organization, is that perpetuation of these myths is particularly costly for residents and their families. Yes, we as taxpayers pay for the vast majority of nursing home care, and we deserve to get value for the money we put into it, and accountability for it, as I talked about earlier on. But who's harmed by this most? Residents and their families. So I'm going to talk about some of our policy priorities and recommendations, some of the things that we have identified. We've been thinking a lot about this, especially, I would say, starting in the fall, and we are putting together materials. This is what I'm going to provide is some highlights of some of the issues that we've identified in terms of our advocacy. Eric will talk about some of the resources that are available on our website. But what we're doing right now, and we'll be announcing this in the next month or two, is we're putting together a web resource, because who can remember all this? We're not expecting residents or families or people who work with residents and families to necessarily remember all these things. But like that fact sheet that I mentioned before on Medicaid, so-called Medicaid losses, and arguing that those are really counterfactual. There's just not a basis for that facility argument that they're losing money, is that we want people to have the resources so when they talk to their legislatures, both on the state and the federal level, when they talk to people in their counties, county-run and state-run nursing homes or VA facilities or nonprofit entities, that they know, look, this is what is going on. There's some basis for our concerns, and that we as residents and family members should never be told there's not enough staff. That's just not an acceptable argument. So here in regard to instituting meaningful accountability when facilities fail to provide adequate and humane care, is that we must improve enforcement of regulatory violations by adopting more specific guidelines for identifying harm and imposing penalties. As I mentioned before, even when the state surveyors are in and substantiate a problem, they only identify that as causing any resident harm or putting any resident in immediate jeopardy about 4.5% of the time. We need to increase the budget for both federal and state regulatory oversight. Too many of our states just are not putting enough money, don't have enough boots on the ground to ensure that residents are safe. Right now, surveys under the federal rules for nursing homes must take place within on an annual basis overall, with a window of between 9 and 15 months. That has proven itself to be wholly inadequate. We strongly believe that survey frequency should be between 6 and 12 months, again, giving the state some flexibility to perhaps focus more on problem facilities, focus on issues that complaints, et cetera, but it should be a 6 to 12 month window, not a window that could be as much as 15 months. And some states are not even meeting that 15 month threshold. Lastly, is that we need to have more independence and professionalism among state survey staff. Too often I hear from ombudsmen, from family members, from residents themselves, from lawyers and others, that when they make a complaint to the state survey agency, they are dismissed. They are told, families are told, well, that's not something we deal with, go to the ombudsman. That's virtually never appropriate. Someone could go to the ombudsman in addition, but there are strong rules, and the states are responsible for ensuring that care and quality of life is not dismissed, that it is investigated, and that the state survey agencies are working to hold nursing homes accountable. But again, we've seen over the last, I would say, 5 to 10 years, especially, a continued erosion of the separation between survey staff and the nursing home industry. The last presidential administration actually actively said that the nursing homes industry, the facilities, were the customers that they were working for, not vulnerable residents, not families, not the public. We need to turn that around, and now is the time to do it. We need to improve accountability for the money that goes to nursing home care. We're calling for, as I mentioned before, a couple of states have moved towards adopting this, a direct care ratio to ensure that, or to limit, I should say, the funds that can be diverted from resident care to administrative costs and to profits, to related party transactions, et cetera. I want to also mention here on the second to last bullet, this is something that has really bothered me over the years, is that we've seen in care, generally speaking, in this country, as well as increasingly in nursing home care, a move to what's called value-based payment. It's something that we, and what I mentioned before about actually identifying when we make a mistake and culpability that nursing homes have, I haven't heard a single nursing home owner or operator or representative say they're sorry or say that they could have done better with COVID. 15 years ago, when we first did a study on nursing home reimbursement, we thought it would be a good idea to tie nursing home quality to payment and to somehow that would encourage payment. Unfortunately, that doesn't work in the real world. But this is not as a result of our doing anything necessarily, but this is something that has moved forward. It's called value-based payment. It used to be called pay for performance, that you are paying providers, whether it be doctors in the community or hospitals, or here we're talking about nursing homes, you're going to pay them more to provide better care. And the problem with this, in short, is that there are very limited parameters or criteria that can be used when you develop a system like this. So what happens is that the facilities, the industry, which is, again, very, very sophisticated, they start, if you do a value-based payment, say on rehospitalizations or falls risks, those are good things. You don't want people to go to the hospital unnecessarily. You don't want people to fall, obviously. But what happens is that the operators tend to focus on those things for which they're being rewarded, and then they ignore other things. The value-based payment programs, in essence, are not a holistic approach to providing good care. And that's why we no longer support them. Lastly, is that we believe that Congress should redesign the payment system. As I've mentioned a couple of times, Medicaid payments tend to be much lower than Medicare payments are. They tend to be much, much higher. That there needs to be a rebalancing. And one idea that we like, again, we're open to ideas about this, is having a blended rate so that there is less discrimination against Medicaid, people who are Medicaid, for whom nursing homes are still likely making money, but are not making as much money as they are on the Medicare residents. This is a quote from the Times article that I mentioned before about the how 85% of nursing homes use related party transactions. And this is the title of the article was "Care Suffers as More Nursing Homes Feed Money into Corporate Webs." I also want to mention improving, and I want to move on so Eric has time to talk. I've gone on a little bit longer than I expected. I'm sorry. So and we'll stay on for questions. If those of you who want to stay on for questions as well, we can go beyond 2 o'clock. But lastly is improving transparency and accountability for nursing home owners and managers. Is that we have so many different layers of ownership and limited liability companies and real estate investment trusts, et cetera, is that we have no good way of keeping track of it. Our state survey agencies, our federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, they just have not kept up with the sophistication of the industry. And we need to take steps, both through regulation, possibly through law as well, to ensure that if you have a ownership interest, that you are connected, held accountable for the care that is provided in the facilities that you own or operate. And lastly, we need to ensure safe, sufficient, and humane staffing levels. We talk about safe staffing in terms of care, in terms of clinical care. But as we saw with COVID, you know, there was one study, I think Eric had mentioned it in a previous program we did, that found that for every 2 people who died in a nursing home due to COVID, another person died due to neglect, due to loneliness. Residents have the right to humane care. We know what that takes. But unfortunately, the states and CMS just do not enforce the requirement that nursing homes have sufficient staffing. We really need to have one enforcement of that sufficient staffing level and also a numerical minimum standard. And we need to have RNs in a nursing home, on a 24-hour basis. So I'm going to pass it on to Eric here.
Thanks, Richard.
Sure.
Thanks for that. And as Richard mentioned, we'll go a little bit over for Q&A. Richard's just a gold mine of information on all things long-term care and nursing homes. And what I'm going to try to do in the next 5-10 minutes is to teach you all how to get a lot of this information. I know Richard gets so much of this information and also has the staff put the information on the Nursing Home 411 website. So we want to teach you and help you get the tools and use the tools to advocate for residents in long-term care. So we're going to go through each part of this briefly, but Haley will be providing links in the chat, and we're going to start with our social media, with our new state pages, with our data on staffing and 5-star ratings, our podcast, and our Action Center, then our upcoming program. So next slide, please. All right, so this is a big one. It's an easy A+. What I want you all to do is go to nursinghome411.org/social. And sign up for any of our materials. We have a email distribution list where we provide invites to programs like this. We have a YouTube channel where you can watch this program after it's posted, and you can go back and watch other programs. Over the years, we've covered every corner of the long-term care field, from ownership, from staffing, to you name it. And you can go back and look for our videos, and chances are there's an hour long presentation on it. We also have a podcast, which I'll get to later, where that's on Apple and Spotify, and our Facebook page where we post our own resources, but we also use that to post really whatever relevant news reports are out there. And the same goes for our Twitter page. So yeah, go to nursinghome411.org/social and sign up for one of those, and you can tweet at us or however you want to communicate to us with a screenshot that you did it to let other people know that these are useful resources. Next slide, please. So this is a new exciting resource we have. It's on our homepage. You can log onto our homepage at nursinghome411.org, and you'll see a little USA map, and then you click that, and you can also go to nursinghome411.org. And for each state in the US, we have basic staffing information, ratings, and links to each state's ombudsman resources. These are state specific. And some states we have more materials than others. For example, in New York State, we have far more materials than other states, but each state at minimum has staffing information, has ratings, and has a link to their ombudsman resource. And to do that, you'll go to nursinghome411.org/states, and you'll see this map, and you can click your state there. Now, there's also a trick that if you know your state's two-letter abbreviation, you can just do nursinghome411.org/. We'll go with my home state of Pennsylvania. So nursinghome411.org/PA, or Haley's would be nursinghome411.org/NDNJ. But that's just a shortcut to get there. And next page, please. Next slide. So this is what the New York State page looks like. You'll see on the left is New York related reports. So you'll see the latest staffing report. You'll see an elder justice newsletter where one of the items featured a New York State facility. And you will also on the right feature more of the data components. So that includes the staffing, that includes the ratings, that includes a list of one-star and special focus facilities. I need to remind you all that special focus facility is not good. That means it's a poor performing facility, but you can see the list of those facilities in your state, and you can see the ombudsman and other resources. Next slide, please. This is relatedly our latest staffing report from the fourth quarter of 2020. If you are here, if you follow us, you know that every few months we post a quarterly staffing report, and the pages will look something like this. Again, we have everything. We have individual state files, the same ones that I just mentioned on the state pages. Those are listed on the bottom of the page. We also have national staffing data, including nursing staffing. So that is RNs and CNAs and LPNs, non-nursing. So this is dietitians and administrators, medical directors, physical therapists. We have what percent of facility staff is contracted employees. We have state-by-state comparisons, and we also have daily national data on weekend and holiday trends. And on the next slide, I'm just going to go over a few highlights from the fourth quarter of 2020. And as a reminder, this was October 1st to December 31st for the fourth quarter of 2020. And this was in many places the peak of COVID. In some places it was the second wave, but this took place during the holiday season. And I say highlights or lowlights because the staffing, as has been the case in previous quarters, was not up to standards. Based on our findings, less than a quarter of US nursing homes met the total care staff threshold of 4.1 hours per resident day, as determined by a 2001 landmark federal study. Now, there was a slight increase in the staffing ratio from the previous quarter, but it's important to note that our analysis shows this is more a result of a steep population decline, which I'll get into, and not an overall increase in staff hours. So the declining resident population, largely due to COVID-related deaths, inflated the overall staffing ratio, which continued not to be up to the 4.10 standard. Just one example of the findings and the visuals we produced is the graph on the right, which shows the daily resident census at by week of the fourth quarter of 2020. That is the blue line. You can see it steadily declining from week 1 to 12. And the gray line is the staff HPRD. And you can see that during week 8, which occurred during Thanksgiving, and week 12, which occurred during Christmas week, there was a dip in staffing hours. And as Richard has said before, just because it's the holidays or just because it's the weekends, it doesn't mean that that resident needs are lower than they would be on a normal Tuesday, a non-holiday. So this is problematic, and it certainly did not help things that facilities had fewer staff on those holidays. And one last stat before the next slide, but the average facility census is at 74.3, which is 14.2% below the pre-pandemic Q4 2019 average of 86.6. So I think we've been using the term decimated, but it's the resident population has more than decimated. And next slide, please. So a quick tutorial on using the data. I see in the chat, someone is playing around with the New Jersey data, and you can email me at eric@ltccc.org, and we'll see if we can sort that out, because these spreadsheets can be tricky. But when you click on a state page and you download the spreadsheet, you'll hopefully be brought to a file that looks like this. It's a giant file, but with a lot of information, but it will hopefully look like what you see on this page. And you can use this file to find your facility. You can use it to find the nursing homes in a certain county. Say you're an ombudsman and you want to look at nursing home facilities in Westchester. And I put little boxes around the arrows. If you click those arrows, you'll be brought to a screen where you'll see some of the filtering and sorting options. It can be very tricky, and I understand that there's some trial and error involved. But we're hoping that by including those features, you'll be able to isolate your facilities and your areas of interest. And on the next slide, I'm just going to show you two examples. I know we got some Montrose people in here, and I went to the New York State file and looked up the Montrose, the New York State Veterans Home at Montrose. And I did that by sorting the providers and searching for Montrose. And you'll see that is the Montrose specific data. And on the bottom half of this page is the Westchester County staffing data. So I found this by clicking that tiny little arrow next to county and searching for Westchester, and then you'll be brought to only Westchester facilities, and you can see various data points. And next slide, please. And what I just mentioned with those spreadsheets, Excel spreadsheets, are those strategies to identify information can also be used in some of our other resources. So this page is a screenshot of our Nursing Home 411 data center, where you'll see the staffing information, information or the link to get to nursing home ratings, the link to get to problem facilities, antipsychotic drugging enforcement, and more. And everything I said on staffing, with the exception of the specific categories, is applicable in terms of identifying information on the spreadsheets and these other categories. And next slide. So we, in addition to data, we also produce webinars and podcasts, which are more narrative driven. And we speak to a wide range of people that are linked with nursing homes in one way or another. This includes film directors, which I'll get to, attorneys, data experts who can explain this stuff far better than I can, academics, nursing home residents, staff. We want to get a range of voices so that we are getting a full grasp and helping you get a full grasp of what is going on in nursing homes. And it would be great if you have an iPhone, if you could go to Apple Podcast and subscribe, rate, and review. We're also on Spotify, and Haley will put a link to the Apple Podcasts in the chat. Now, I'm going to play a clip from a recent episode. We actually just released it yesterday with the directors of a documentary that's not yet out yet, but it's called Fire Through Dry Grass. And it follows a group of poets who are residents at the facility in Roosevelt Island, including, you'll see the man on the left. His name is Andres J. Molina. He is a resident of the facility, and he also led this project along with Alexi Neofitidis on the right. And Richard, can you click that little sound button next to, there we go. Let's see.
Literally, we all there feel we institutionalized up in here, because not just the facility is on lockdown, but when a certain some patient or nurse comes back a positive for COVID in any certain unit, they close that unit too for 14 days. So it's basically being a jail within a jail.
Right. So yeah, so that's just the type of perspective you'll hear on the episode we just released. But we hear from a range of people, including CNA, attorneys, academics, and a number of people. So yeah, please give that a listen, and I think you'll enjoy it. And next slide. And lastly, before we get to the upcoming programs, is our Action Center. And this gives you a chance to, tell your story. It helps our LTCCC's advocacy when we hear from you and understand the type of issues that you and your loved ones are facing. And on this page, you can also write your legislators on key issues such as enforcement and safe staffing. We will have a template of text that you can send the legislators, but you are welcome to add to it, to personalize it. And this, we have this, it's called like the Every Action Center, and it allows us to really reach these legislators. And when you are advocating, it makes a difference. And this is New York State and national. Now, we have some upcoming programs ahead, including I'm really excited about this one. It's our ombudsman program, the best ombuds of Hudson Valley and Tri-County. Richard mentioned before, LTCCC hosts two ombudsman programs directed by Gloria Murray and Judy Farrell. This is the Hudson Valley and the Tri-County. And for an hour on June 17th, they will share all of the secrets and all of the resources and all of the best ways that you can leverage the ombudsman services, the free ombudsman services. And they're also going to talk about the importance of volunteering. The only way that these ombudsman programs work is on the backs of volunteers. And it really, those contributions make such a difference. And I know there's a lot of you who are passionate about not just your loved ones, but about residents in general. And we're hoping that we can find some passionate volunteers to contribute. And we also have a couple other programs. This one is June 15th at 1 p.m. With Tina Alonzo, Why Comfort Matters, Reducing Reliance on Antipsychotics. The event link is there. Then we have a New York State Bar Association program. It's actually, we co-sponsor it. It'll be on the NYSBA website, Moving Beyond Institutional Nursing Home Care. And I think that's it for our programs. And we're going to wrap up with a Q&A. Lastly, If your program supervisor allows credit for attending this training program, please take the survey at the link on this page. It's going to be posted in the chat, but it's surveymonkey.com/r/LTCCC-LTCOP1. And again, that's in the chat. Thanks. Thanks for attending this, and thanks for hopefully signing up for all of LTCCC's resources.
Thanks so much, Eric. I'm going to start my video too, and I will. Hi, everyone. That was excellent, and I apologize to Eric and to everyone because I hogged up much more time than I expected. As I mentioned in an email this morning, I feel very passionate about these issues, and there's so much that we could do. And so much of it is, you know, I know everyone has limited bandwidth. And so we want to be there to help you all and to provide any resources. You know, the materials that Eric spoke about, one, they're constantly updated. So, you know, one reason to sign up for alerts and stuff from us, we never sell our email names or lists or anything like that, is that you'll find out when things are updated. And those resources, like the staffing and the quality information, can be used if you are if you're advocating for an individual or as an individual in a nursing home, to see how your facility is doing, how it compares to other facilities in your community. And you can certainly use that information and share it with local and state and federal legislators and use those resources to help you speak out. Because, you know, I mentioned before how powerful the industry is, how much money there is behind the industry. Money talks, as we all know, especially in politics. And the legislators, again, both state and national, mostly hear from providers. And mostly what they hear are those myths, is we don't get enough money to provide good care, and we can't find staffing. So it's up to anyone who is able to please speak out. It really can make a difference. So I'm going to, we are over, but we will stay on for another 10 minutes or so for questions. Again, if you have a question, please put it in the Q&A. Unfortunately, we aren't able to take like raised hands or anything like that. We are moving forward with our technology, but I want to make this fair, of course, for everyone too. So question number one was, I'm trying to find a placement for a friend with some dementia. I don't know where to look for current reliable information. Can we recommend any sites? And Eric, feel free to chime in if you want to, but I would say, you know, Eric was pointing to some of the information that we have. Essentially, I think there are two good resources out there. One is called Care Compare. It's on the Medicare.gov website. That's the federal website. And that provides information. You can look at the star ratings for nursing homes. You can look at information on citations, some ratings for staffing. I think, to be honest, the information that we provide on staffing is a bit better. The information on Nursing Home Compare is risk adjusted. It's I think that it is not quite as good as what we're providing. What I would do, and what I do when I get, we don't have the bandwidth, unfortunately, or the staffing to provide individual assistance. But when I do get a family member or a friend who asks me for help personally, I look at Nursing Home Compare. I look to see if I could find anything with at least a 4 or 5 star rating. And then I will take a quick look on our website and look to see what their staffing is. And in particular, look to see what their overall average staffing is per resident per day and what their RN staffing is per resident per day. And as Eric noted, 4.1 hours of staffing time per resident per day is really what is needed, what federal studies have identified as essential to meet residents' basic clinical needs, and of that time, 0.75 hours should be RN. So you can use the website, as Eric was saying, to select facilities in counties that you may be looking for, and then to see where they rank in terms of those staffing criteria. And lastly, in terms of someone with dementia or if someone has other special needs, I would also look to see possibly what their staffing is for activities at the activity staff, which we also provide information on, that I would try to go someplace that has a higher activities staffing numbers, because that is really important for residents with dementia. And I would also look to see what their antipsychotic drugging rates are. We are waiting to hear from more recent data. We put in requests to CMS to get that information. And then whenever we get it, we provide it to the public on antipsychotic drugging, but it is a very critical issue when it comes to dementia care in particular. Next question is from Vicky. She's saying, are you saying that during COVID, the staffing standards were not relaxed? And that is correct. Staffing standards were not, well, let me be careful here. So the requirements to have sufficient staffing were absolutely not relaxed. However, and we were not happy about this, CMS, the federal government, relaxed the standards for the people providing care so that they allowed facilities, this was up to the state, so they allowed states to allow their facilities to, instead of having a CNA, now I don't want to get too much into the weeds in our last few minutes, but you know, under federal rules, you have to be at least a certified nurse aide to provide care in a nursing home. What CMS did was that in order to be a CNA, you have to meet a state certification, state certification training, and that requires under the federal rules at least 75 hours of training. Many states now have increased that substantially to 100, 125, even 150 hours, as I recall. What CMS said in response to COVID is that facilities can hire CNAs without any training. They left that up to the states. And what many states did was they adopted an 8-hour training program. I think about 20 states did this. They adopted an 8-hour training program from the American Healthcare Association, which is the lobby association for mostly for the for-profit industry. So we went from a minimum of 75 hours in certification to an 8-hour training. And let me tell you, this is one of the things I first researched when I started at the coalition. 75 hours is not sufficient to teach about dementia care and dignity and helping people with bathing and helping people with dining and you know, everything else. 75 hours is not enough. So just from our perspective, just when residents were in greatest need with COVID-19, CMS, to our chagrin, relaxed those standards drastically. So now they're moving back, and this is something we're advocating about. I didn't want to have time to get into it here, but it's something we're advocating too, is to make sure that the people who have been working in facilities without the training, we want to make sure that they get the training, that they are required within a certain amount of time to get the certification training that everyone else needs in order to provide resident care. So sorry for the long answer. Generally speaking, the staffing standards, the numbers sufficient, the ability of staff to provide appropriate care, that was not changed. However, the training requirements were temporarily changed. Marcus asked, whatever happened to the recommendations of the Commission for Safety and Quality in Nursing Homes? Are any of them going to be followed? I did not think a lot of that commission. I don't want to speak too broadly, and I don't frankly recall all the recommendations that they made. But as I hope I've said over, you know, in the 40 or so minutes that I spoke, the standards are good. The standards are strong, and the standards have been around for 30 years now, since 1991, when those rules implementing the 87 reform law were implemented. The problem is that, as our friend and colleague Toby Edelman of the Center for Medicare Advocacy says, they're not self-implemented. Just because they exist doesn't mean that they're implemented in the lives of residents unless they are enforced. So The recommendations are, I think, that we need to have enforcement. We now can see what an utter catastrophe it can be for residents if the rules are allowed to be flouted. Janine asked the question, is the federal government and the Veterans Administration aware of how New York State nursing home residents are suffering? Who at the federal level can we contact besides Chuck Schumer? And this is really a good question for anybody. So I think that for anyone, no matter what state they're in, excuse me, is that it's important, as I mentioned, I think earlier, mostly what our legislators, both state and Congress, our governors, and the presidential administration, most of what they hear from are the nursing home industry, their lobbyists, the law firms that also lobby for the nursing home industry, the American Healthcare Association that I just mentioned, Leading Age, the two main lobby associations. They have branches, I think, in every state as well. They are sitting, the offices in DC are sitting on, last I saw, about $30 million each. They have money to take people out to lunch, to go to $5,000 golf games, to contribute to political campaigns. Residents generally do not. And our organization, the Center for Medicare Advocacy, the Consumer Voice, the state organizations, they don't have that type of funding. And we don't, to my knowledge, none of us do that kind of lobbying. So they need to hear from families. They need to hear from residents that these issues are important and that we want to have accountability and that we want to have transparency and that we have a right to get both value for the money we spend and to be treated decently. Marcus asked, what is the status of the mandatory arbitration rules that the last administration allowed? So as Marcus noted, in 2016, this wasn't really a political thing, but it was under the Obama administration. CMS, when it revised the nursing home rules, they prohibited the use of mandatory arbitration, meaning that nursing homes and assisted living do this as well. They will insert a clause in their residency contract, generally speaking, saying, you promise you will never sue this nursing home, no matter what happens to your resident, and you will go instead to arbitration. And that really tilts the balance against residents and families and to the facilities, whether it be nursing homes or assisted living. So again, in regard to nursing homes, when those rules came out in 2016, they prohibited pre-dispute arbitration agreements. A family could say, we want to go to arbitration, but only at the time, only if something bad happened. No one brings their family member, no one goes into a nursing home expecting that there'll be abuse, expecting that there'll be neglected to death. So they shouldn't be asked to, at that point, say, oh, we're never going to sue. We're never going to exercise our rights as Americans, as citizens or residents of this country to go to a court of law. That should never happen. So the status is that under the Trump administration, the lobby associations for the industry immediately got in, even before the president was in office, and said that they wanted to have some of the nursing home rules relaxed. And the administration did succeed in relaxing the arbitration rules. And we're hoping that we can reverse that. It's certainly one of our advocacy issues going forward. It's not one that I mentioned today, but it is an important one. I don't want to spend too much time. Why is it important, though? It's important because in the absence of enforcement, in the absence of meaningful accountability by the states and by CMS, oftentimes it's only a family member or only a resident, but usually it's a family member who holding a facility accountable through a lawsuit can make a difference in that resident's lives. Sarah, and I'm going to go through, I think we have three more. So I know, I apologize to Eric and to everyone because I took up way more time than I should have, but we're going to try to wrap these up in the next 6 minutes. Sarah says, you've done an incredible job gathering data on nursing home deficiencies, immense profits, lack of care and safety for residents. How can this be used to enact substantive and thoughtful change? So I would say, hopefully, we are, as Eric mentioned, we have the Action Alert Center, calling your legislators, sending email messages, sending letters, getting other people to call and to do the same thing is absolutely critical. Letting them know that these are priorities for us. I remember one of my first meetings again with legislators, it was in New York State almost 20 years ago. And the person said to me at the end, as we were leaving, said, nothing will happen until people hear, legislators hear from their constituents that these are important issues. And we're still at the same place today. So it is really, really important to make a quick phone call, send an email. Again, you can do that through our Action Alert site, or you could do that directly by calling Congress and asking for your leader or calling your state legislator. Bridget, hello. Regarding poor food, is there a way for family members of residents to demand a printout of the nursing home's food budget, which covers how and what the money is allocated? No, so I'm sorry, there isn't. So there are cost reports. They are extremely complex. And that was one of the recommendations I spoke about very briefly. And again, we are developing a webpage that'll be dedicated to nursing home reform. We're putting together those materials now, and we hope to announce it in the next month or two to provide more information on advocacy around issues like this, because there should be transparency. There should be a way to find out what is a facility budgeting towards food, how much is it budgeting towards staff. And that's something that we strongly support. So yeah, unfortunately there isn't at this time. One or two more questions from Patricia. I'm an ombudsman. The company that bought the home I service also owns a paper company. They forced their diapers on our residents and they were poor quality. All they want is to use the home to make money. We cannot know who the owner is either, so we may complain. Can your group keep an updated list of homeowners? That is really hard to do, and the reason why I say that is because the ownership does change. We did a study on ownership in that 2018, so now about 3 years ago. And that study, that data that we collected is already out of date. It is one of the things, as I said, one of my slides was transparency about ownership and making that available to the public. Now, if you go on Care Compare at the Medicare website, you can see ownership information. Nursing homes have to report, as a result of actually the Affordable Care Act, so-called Obamacare, one of the things that we and other advocates argued for and got into that bill was that nursing homes have to report and CMS has to publish the ownership information. So anyone with a 5% or greater ownership interest in a nursing home is required to provide that information on Care Compare. Now, it may be it's self-reported. I don't think there's been a lot of auditing of it. I know sometimes that information can, even on Care Compare, be a little out of date, but that is the best information available for quickly finding out who owns a facility. And with that, again, thank you so much for joining us and for staying with us for a full additional hour. I really appreciate it. Thank you again, Eric, for squeezing in a lot of information in a shorter period of time. I appreciate that too. This is, you know, the podcasts are really Eric and Eric and Haley are the ones who are doing so much now on our website to try to provide information for you and members of the public so they can find out and speak out about nursing homes in your community and beyond. I hope you'll join us again. Meanwhile, have a pleasant start to the summer. And I have to say, those of you who in the past, when I was giving a program, I used to hear Zelda. She's been quietly sleeping at my feet. Zelda is my miniature schnauzer. So we didn't get to hear from Zelda today, but you got to hear from me and Eric, and I hope it was useful. And thank you all very much. Bye-bye now.